Welcome to the Guardian Book Club. My name's John Mullen, and I'm here to talk to A.S. Byatt about her novel Possession. Of course, A.S. Byatt's written many novels, including her most recent one, The Children's Book. But Possession is, I mean, Possession won the Booker Prize, but I think it's also one of those novels which sort of, by doing so and by becoming the bestseller that it became, also shifted our idea of what literary fiction was and could be. I think it shifted lots of publishers' idea of what might actually be popular and be sellable to readers. Books full of layers of literary parody and pastiche and quotation, which seemed to appeal to only the most well-read reader, and yet which was hugely popular and absorbing. And one of the reasons that we've left it so long to have A.S. Byatt to the book club is that actually about 5 or 6 years ago, when I did a rather different sort of column about recent fiction in The Guardian, I did Possession. So I've been sort of kind of waiting for the distance to grow between me and that. And so, and I did sort of 4 columns on it on certain topics. And this time I've done a couple more. And one of the things, and I'm going to do another one. And actually, I've got 3 or 4 in reserve. Because it's that kind of book. It's just absolutely fantastically full of things that, in the construction and the delight of seeing the construction, you feel you're rather clever at unravelling. Of course, it's a book about clever people unravelling clues and mysteries about writing in the past. But like, I confess, my favourite writers, like, I don't know, I suppose Jane Austen's a very good example, has this wonderful thing. It makes you feel you're clever while you're reading it. And I read it for the book club, for it must be about the 4th time actually, and I felt clever reading it, partly because I discovered some plot clues which I had very stupidly not seen before, so it was sort of, I was becoming cleverer and cleverer. On the website, on the Guardian review website, there's a book club bit where people can blog in their thoughts about the book that we're doing. And there's lots of stuff this month about Possession. I wonder, I was going to start by asking you about the thing that the bloggers have been most exercised about. I wonder if you could guess what aspect of the novel, a very, very unfair question. I wonder if you can guess what aspect of the novel they most debate and differ about and argue about.
I can't really guess about the bloggers, but people are always accusing me of being too clever. So I assume rather gloomily that the bloggers are also...
Given that bloggers are usually rather sort of rude, these bloggers are actually quite polite. Have you produced a better class of blogger than is usually attracted to the Guardian blog space? Is that a... But the thing that they are really exercised about... surprised me is the I call them, perhaps you'll correct the word I use, the pastiches.
Yes.
That's the thing they most have argued about. And it's funny, given that you know, quite a few people I've heard say, oh, it's a fantastic book. I wasn't much worried about the bits of sort of Victorian poetry, but the rest of it's fantastic. And some people confess to skipping it or... And yet the bloggers, that's what they're arguing about. You know, how authentic is it? How good is it? What is it like? What models are she using? I mean, does that surprise you?
Well, it rather cheers me up. I've written a piece for The Guardian, which I think will come out as part of your series, about how it became clear to me that because I was writing about the fact that poetry was more important than scholarship, and poets were more important than biographers. If I was going to do pastiche of the scholarship, I actually needed there to be real poems on the page. I needed there to be poems that were there, and I was absolutely terrified because as a schoolgirl, I was good at prose and bad at poetry. I mean, I was good at analysing it, but very bad at writing it. I didn't even try, really, because I embarrassed myself. I remember writing a poem when I was about 11, which began, "I have come late to loving roses." And then it went on to say how heavy and fat roses were. Once I saw that I had to write the poetry, I did try to write it as an integral part of the story. So all the poems are written, on the whole, at the place where they come in the novel. They weren't written as a kind of block of stuff that I wrote by myself and then inserted into the novel. As I see it, the language runs steadily in a line of knitting and development through the poems, so they are part of the plot where they come. Equally, I have always said to people I'm talking to about possession, any reader has a right to skip any part of any text. And what I most hoped for, actually, in the early days, was that people would read the novel and then think, well, I'll go back and have a look at the poetry. And a lot of them have. There are also, I've just been on a trip to Finland where this book has just appeared in Finnish, and there are several distracted people wandering around libraries trying to find
Ash.
including Finns.
Yeah.
It's sort of wonderful, really.
Well, it's a funny thing is, actually, I thought I wasn't going to do this, but I did actually copy out one very brief blog comment, which does say, which is from Canada, which says, as for the, where somebody is replying to somebody who says, oh, and they're not sure the poetry is that authentic, they can believe the authenticity. And this is one of the several bloggers who says, oh, yes, you can. And this, I don't know if it's a man or woman, says, as for the authenticity of the poetry, one member of our reading group tried to find out more information about these two Victorian poets on the internet without success. He was convinced they were real people and was surprised and disappointed to find they were not. You might scoff, but we are in the colonies, after all, brackets, Canada. there's quite a few of those around.
Yes, this is now complicated by the fact that there are persons all over who are writing theses on the poetry of Randolph Henry Ash and Christabel Lamotte. So, my favourite of these is a Polish scholar I met some years ago in Leiden. I love the way Europe shifts around. And there was a Pole who was writing his PhD on the poetry of Randolph Henry Ash. And he said to me, Ash makes various mistakes about the life of Swammerdam. I expect you cleverly put those mistakes in order to make him look inauthentic. So I said I wasn't aware there were any mistakes. But anyway, I got all the Swammerdam out of Michelet. And then an awful thing happened because I revealed to him what I was now working on, which was a novel which went from 1895 to 1919. And he said with total authority, well, you will have to write some First World War poetry, won't you? I did. It was very, very difficult. But there is First World War poetry, which is, again, open to people saying whether it's authentic or inauthentic.
Of course, now that you've done it, now that it's there, and particularly because the plot is kneaded into it as well, because of the person who doesn't read it misses things. Whatever pleasures they might miss, they also miss some clues.
They miss a lot of clues, yes.
But I mean, when you now it seems it's there and it's earned its place. But why did you feel that you had to do it? Because I think lots of novelists would not have done it because they couldn't have done. They just wouldn't have had your equipment. But, I mean, it was a sort of... what in the logic of the book made it inescapable? Because it's a really difficult thing to do.
Well, the logic of the book was that poems should be present and that writing literary criticism about poems somehow pushes them into irreality. And, for instance, there's a poem by Christabel about a woman sitting on a stone in the middle of a river. And I'd read lots of feminist literary criticism about female landscapes being full of plashing water and flat areas as opposed to phallic uprisings and things like that. And I wrote a piece of feminist literary criticism of this poem by Christabel about the lady sitting on a rock.
Yes.
Then I thought, it is wrong if the lady sitting on a rock isn't present. So I wrote the piece of literary criticism before I wrote the poem. But I wanted the reader to think the poem was more interesting. And I got a letter from a lady in New Zealand who said, "This is a disgusting piece," meaning the criticism. "This is a horrible piece of writing. I have come to accept it because I realised you had to show that you could do it if you wanted to, and you were not doing it." I felt quite cheered up by that. But
there is sometimes a sense, I think, in the novel that some of the parody or pastiche you do, not so much of the poetry, but the other kinds of document, are there because, or you know, there because you like doing it, you know. But you don't actually have to have it, all of it. I mean, it's just a pleasure for it to be there.
Well, it's all very interesting because I was in the middle of the quartet that begins with the Virgin in the Garden when I wrote this book. And I'd got sort of to a point of exhaustion with realist prose, and particularly with describing people's feelings. I suddenly thought, I can't go on doing that. I want to write in a different way. And one of the different ways I write in is writing fairy stories, where nobody has any feelings. They just go from A to B to C to D. And the other was sort of writing the poetry and writing the parodies. And I found it much easier to tell a story in very large numbers of voices than a modern story with a narrator saying she felt terrible, he had let her down yet again. I mean, you can write that sentence, in that book because there's all sorts of other stuff in that book. But I didn't want to write a whole book anymore ever that went on like that. And so it was a sort of, it was a release. The other thing I should say is that I grew up on Tennyson and Browning, not all Victorian poetry, just those two. When I was a very little girl, I knew the Lady of Shalott by heart, and I knew the Pied Piper by heart. And the actual rhythms that have fixed themselves in the structure of my brain come from Tennyson and Browning. I was such a little girl, and my mother gave me those poems. It was one of the best things she ever did for me. And so, in a sense, it turned out to be easy because I was haunted by the rhythms, I was possessed by...
Because I've read sort of critical essays, or perhaps they've been reviews, I don't know, which have sort of said, well, yes, of course she does sort of Browning's blank verse quite well. Yes, I mean, you know, as if that's a sort of, you know, a facility that
anyone can have.
And I remember once, actually, you know, I mean, if you ask, I don't know, literature students, I mean, quite sort of trained and clever ones, to write a few lines of just blank verse about anything. They find it incredibly difficult just to get it to sort of scan, and most of them don't successfully.
You have a chair at UCL, and I was teaching at UCL when I embarked on this novel. And there was a colleague I had called Basil Greenslade who said that what we should actually ask every student coming in to do was write a proper sonnet with all the structures in it, then they would see how difficult it was, and also they might get really interested. And I still wish that happened.
Yes, it might cut down the numbers quite successfully. Thinking of the academic thing, because of course you know, I wrote my first of my columns about the satirical, as I thought, aspect of the novel, which it seemed. I often wonder, actually, whether, as an academic, that sort of leaps out at me in a way that it wouldn't to other people. But reading it now, it feels... I mean, it's very funny. It's very funny and appallingly recognisable, actually, some of it. But it sort of makes me think, well, perhaps for most readers, I often think as an academic anyway, if they knew what twaddle we taught, they would not believe it. But luckily, they never get really to hear it, because the books of twaddle are only read by other twaddlers. And, no, but you know what I'm saying.
One of the reasons I'm here is because I feel that you yourself have done an enormous amount to restore writing to the reader. You write reviews in really good English with no twaddle.
Oh, you're embarrassing. No.
And I know I'm embarrassing you, but I mean, the fact that you were there has cheered me up about contemporary cultural life, and I feel I should say this. And the twaddle is not 100% twaddle.
No.
I mean, I've read an essay by Derrida on La Métaphore Blanche, which is one of the most beautiful things I've ever read in my life. But mostly, particularly the derivative English, which is reading the French stuff even in translation, it is exactly what you called it. And I began to feel that I had to leave university teaching. I mean, I needed to write books anyway. But I had to leave university teaching partly because of literary theory, which I thought... I once examined a woman student who was writing on women's writing, and she wrote on two scenes in one novel by Charlotte Bronte. And when, as an external examiner, I interviewed her viva voce and said, but, you know, does what you say also apply to Jane Austen and George Eliot? This young lady replied... you don't think I have time to read all those novels. I've had to read all this literary theory. This is a true story.
Well, and in the, but actually, the great thing, I suppose, about the novel in that aspect is that it has a... I mean, there are these wonderful bits of parody academic discussion and academic prose. But there's also this wonderful... There's this plot. Part one of the consequences of which is that lots of these characters find out that they've been talking baloney. And I always think one of the great... I mean, Leonora, I really like her as a character, and I sort of... Some people sort of say, well, no, she's a bit... And I've met Leonora. I've definitely met Leonora. I've definitely met... But one of the great things about her, actually, as a character, and one of the reasons that I think that it works, is that she is... I think she's brilliantly sort of resilient in the face of that discovery. You know, it doesn't sort of stop her in her tracks at all. The fact that she's written this clever article about this poem, Melusina, about the sort of repressed lesbian feelings in it. And in fact, if it's about anything personal at all, it's about her going off to Yorkshire with this man. And the discovery, but it only stops her for a second before she surges onwards. And I thought that was something rather admirable about in a sort of ghastly way, actually.
No, I do love Leonora. I mean, one of the characteristics of me is that, I have it in common with Terry Pratchett, is that I like to love my characters. And even if they start out nasty, yes, or bad, I start trying to imagine them from within. And see, you know, I find admirable things in them.
Because even Blackadder becomes quite sort of lovable in a way, doesn't he?
Well, it's partly that the plot shakes him out of his very tedious, boring habits.
Yes.
But he does become lovable, and they all get to a scene which is in some ways, you know, around the graveside. Or in the hotel afterwards, derived from a scene in Georgette Heyer's The Grand Sophie.
Oh, right. No, I didn't know that.
There's a whole lot of people. Do you remember? They all... There's somebody there who actually...
Bit of intertextuality.
This sort of sense of everybody coming together and having to be friends with each other. And something in me, I like that about Heyer. She doesn't dislike her characters.
Yes.
And Pratchett will bring up a great villain.
Yes.
And in the next book, the villain is not quite so awful and has done some rather strange things. And four books later, the villain has got into a central position of the author feeling great effect. He can't help it.
Yes.
And it's very moving. And I think I'm rather the same.
Yeah, so even Mortimer Cropper is...
Well, he's an American pirate.
Yes.
He's not a bad man.
The thing I always remember about him is the certain uncertainness of his sexual predilections, I think the great fact that you don't actually tell us what they are makes him curiously more sympathetic, actually, this kind of, this man, you know, kind of copying documents with his funny machine in people's lavatories. I ended up feeling sort of slightly sorry for him. And also it's all because of some relative, isn't it? Because the forebear who was into seances and table tapping.
Yes.
So is that a sort of George Eliot thing? If you find out enough about any character, then they can never be as bad as you might have found it convenient to think them.
I used to argue about this with Iris Murdoch. She said, could you really write an evil character? And there are novelists who can write evil characters, but I don't think I can. I was brought up by the Quakers. The Quakers assume that everybody has good in their soul. But it's partly also, I think, that I write from many points of view. I see the whole story through many people's eyes, not just one. And if you're seeing the story through people's eyes, you find it difficult to regard them as evil or horrible. Cropper's sexual predilections and his library, they all go back to kind of American Gothic. He represents American Gothic for me. But one of the things, you probably did pick it up, why is his collection called the Stamped Collection?
Oh. Now, she asked me this really difficult question before we started about recognising a title quotation.
And I got it right.
But nobody was here.
You're the only person stamped. I have asked who got it right. Shall I tell you?
Yeah, go on.
You know Charlotte Stamped, who was collected... She's in the Golden Bowl. She's the English woman.
Oh, I was going to say Henry James and I didn't dare.
Yeah, there you are.
Oh, it's
and taken
like
off to the Midwest where she was very unhappy.
Yeah.
But nobody's ever, as far as I know, picked that up.
And the fact nobody else has ever got it makes it even worse. I didn't get it.
Anyway.
Can I ask you about the points of view, actually? Because that's, I suppose, actually doing the book club, doing it over the last 2 or 3 years... one of the things that I find myself obsessed with is, but which you don't really notice when you're reading a book for the pleasure and delight of it, is especially in third-person narratives, when an author who is moving around between different points of view chooses to, with two characters, I know, they're Roland and Maud, and why, you know, we're seeing it from his point of view, and then at a certain point seeing something from her point. You know, why do we decide that? And I suppose to sharpen it to something specific, in the passages which do indeed return us to the 19th century, not via letters, but directly via narrative, you give us, especially the very, I think, important chapter which takes us with Randolph and Christabel to Yorkshire. Obviously, it's incredibly important in the story, but I think it's very important in the novel, if one may make the distinction.
Yes.
It's partly from the outside, and it's partly from his point of view, but not from her point of view. I think I'm right in saying. Then later on, there's another chapter which gives us a bit of narrative from immediately after his death, from his wife's, her thoughts, and indeed it is all her thoughts. But we never, I think, get Christabel's thoughts, except in letters. So, I mean, why is that?
It's quite complicated, the answer, but part of the answer is simple. I have spent a lot of my life defending George Eliot's authorial voice, which I think is actually a very subtle thing, from the idea that she was writing as though she was God. No novelist has ever written as though they were God, except possibly Balzac, and he keeps failing and getting in a mess and getting in a muddle. It doesn't matter because he's wonderful. But there was a lot of, from the undergraduates and the staff when I was teaching at UCL, just before I wrote this, you know, they said that she was trying to write like God. Mm. I think that the third-person author, much more than the one who writes in the first person, is writing for the reader. The author is talking to the reader and all the characters are living their lives, and that's fine by me. I prefer it to a sort of single voice, you know, I felt this, I felt that. So there are actually three... I don't think you see it from Christabel's point of view either. I think the bit between Randolph and Christabel is told by the author. And you're right about Ellen Ashe. And the last bit that is told by the author is the epilogue.
Yes, yes.
And this is because the author is talking to the readers. And the author is telling the readers things that no scholar will ever discover. So that's those bits of the novel which are nearest, paradoxically, to the Victorian novel. And that was quite a deliberate technical thing that I did.
Is it also something to do with the fact that that Christabel, the character Christabel, and the character of her, of the poetry that you make for her, and in parallel the character of Maud, with her extraordinary headdress, is she has to be quite remote, doesn't she? So when that, I mean, there's a bit, for instance, when it is authorial, but there's a bit when they're in Yorkshire, they're collecting ammonites or something, and there's a bit of narrative where we, as it were, hear Randolph thinking about the shape of her body.
Yes.
And so you're being taken into the very private place that none of the characters in the present day are ever going to know about. But we're not we never get that kind of intimate access to her, do we? And that sort of seems part of a kind of decision you make about her sort of distance.
This distinction actually applies to all novels. I mean, every novel I've written, there have been characters into whose mind I felt I absolutely had to go. And there's also always been characters who are described only from the outside.
Yes.
And you work out, not absolutely at the beginning of writing the book, but quite early on, that certain characters are forbidden. They're always seen by other people. And I don't always know why this happens, but it happens because of the structure of the work of art as I see it. And there were, in my very first novel, I remember thinking that the academic in that was always seen by the other characters and his thoughts couldn't be told unless in dialogue. And it's gone on rather like that. There are people who appear, I mean, there's a very repulsive novelist in my new book who keeps seducing people, but you don't see into his mind ever. You see him sitting naked in a cabbage patch, but you don't see what he's thinking.
Yeah.
It's largely involuntary. I planned out that contact between the reader and the novel in the bits that were told that modern people never discovered. But the people you go inside and the people you don't go inside are done rather by instinct.
Right.
I recognise which kind they are. And, of course, you can play with it. You can treat somebody as a character you absolutely don't go inside until two-thirds of the way through the book, and then you can just once go inside. I don't know if I've ever done that, but it would be quite interesting.
It's funny. It's funny because the month before last, we had P.D. James here, and she was saying, we were talking about the same thing, but being a detective writer, she had a very sort of, it was kind of a very pragmatic thing. She said, the people whose minds you don't get inside are the ones who might have done the murder, you know.
No, that's clever, yes.
I mean, the that moment in the novel where you do suddenly go back to the 19th century, not through letters and evidence and poetry, but through narrative, that feels like I remember when I first read it, that felt like quite a risky moment because you'd been up to then, the interest and the pleasure and the whole complicatedness of the novel was to do with the fact that in a way you had exactly the same evidence as the academic investigators in front of you. If there was a letter that they read, there it was. And then suddenly, did you always know that that chapter would sort of have to come? And did you feel that, I mean, I think reading it now, I've probably, you know, I've studied it perhaps more closely than you have, but I mean, it reads as though it's very carefully, as though you felt you had to write it very carefully at the time. Did it feel a sort of risky?
It felt risky, and it's there for exactly the same reasons. There had to be real poems and not just references to poems. You know, somehow the past had to be real.
Yes, yes.
In ways that were not entirely being recreated or discovered by the modern people. And I write novels, not biographies, because you can do that kind of thing with made-up people. Whereas, in fact, people in biographies are always unreal. They only consist, if you write a good biography, of evidence. No biographer should say he felt, she felt.
Yes, yes.
They should only quote. And I wanted very much to show that precisely because you are a novelist, you have the right to say he felt, she felt, or he said,
yes,
she said.
Yes.
That's very, very important to me, that.
On this same issue of you as a novelist being able to do what the biographer can't do and provide what the modern-day characters can't know, I want to talk about the ending, and the postscript has it, in the introduction to the postscript, the narrative actually says, this is how it was. I mean, the ending, first time you read Possession, the ending is... it's a kind of coup de théâtre, actually, I thought it was. Because you've got an ending which you thought was an ending, and then actually you've got a postscript which sort of undoes the ending and also brilliantly shows that even the most intelligent and sort of right people in the book have got some things wrong, haven't they?
Yeah.
Which is very satisfying and salutary, narratively speaking. But I have one, I've got a sort of itch about it. There's one thing, because it's so brilliantly done, which is a thing which obviously they had problems about when they made the film, because they changed it, which is Ash giving the message to his daughter to be taken to Christabel. And the message, it's about, and of course it's characteristically and beautifully literary about the Belle Dame sans merci. And she, of course, forgets the message. She goes off and plays instead. And I think in the film, it's a letter because they couldn't show her forgetting. So they had to show her dropping a letter. Yeah. So Christabel never gets the message. And you've written this brilliant ending where everybody in the present who digs up the grave ends up thinking that Randolph Ashe never knew that he had this daughter. But he did know. The hair in the grave isn't Christabel's, it's May's, it's the daughter's. But one consequence of this seems quite cruel to Christabel, because she, when she hears that Ash is dying, writes him the letter that he never receives, that's put in the grave, in which she expresses guilt and anguish that she never told him before. And if she'd got that message from May... that would have relieved her of that. But exactly. She doesn't get the message. That's quite tough on her, isn't it?
It's extremely tough on her. But if she had have got the message, the story couldn't have stopped there. And her poetry is the poetry of a person, as she said, I'm an old woman who sits alone in a tower and writes poems. What I wanted to write the ending for was because... there was a moral reason. It came to me that Ash was a good and a determined man, and he knew he had a child, and he would look for it.
Yes.
And that I couldn't just leave him accepting all that stuff in the séance. And so he would have found her. And, I mean, it's tragic from the point of view of both the dead people, because if he had had any inkling that this child was unhappy, I think he might have gone and said, this is my child... you know, perhaps I could have her. But because she was so happy, which meant I had to write all those flowers and everything, he knew she was okay and that he would do well just to go away. So actually his position and Christabel's, he meant to make Christabel's position better, but it failed.
Yes.
But his own wasn't very good either, because he had found his child and couldn't even tell her that she was his child.
Yes.
So you could have written it as a sort of absolutely terrible tragedy, but it actually, I think that bit moves very, very lightly because of the flowers. And my translators have had terrible trouble with the flowers. And the Swedes are arguing with the Danes, are arguing with the Norwegians about precisely which flowers are signified. But... I really minded about there being too many flowers of a very English kind, and there was this tragedy sitting in the middle of the flowers, as tragedies do. And yes, it is very hard, but it needs an intelligent reader to work out how hard it is on both of them.
Well, the best endings are sad. I mean, disgust. Anyway, I've gone on too long already. So, if anybody here... would like to ask Gaius Byatt anything, say anything. Please, this is your chance.
I have a question about how you name your characters, because I recognised a lot of say, Dickens or Collins tropes in the way that the names indicated how the characters acted or didn't act. And I just wondered how you went about choosing and deciding how they were named.
I had a fit of trying. When I invented Frederica Potter, I had the idea that you could write a novel in which all the characters had perfectly ordinary names without meaning. I then discovered that the unconscious of the writer behaves in such a way that they have meaning, nevertheless, whatever you do. So then I went in the other direction and gave them all very complicated allegorical meanings, and I looked for a name that would mean something. And Christabel comes from Coleridge's poem Christabel, and she La Motte is La Motte Fouquet, who wrote Undine, which is Melusina, but it's also the plan of an impenetrable castle with a Motte and Bailey thing going round it, so obviously the modern woman had to be called Bailey, if you see what I mean. And it goes on like, my mind works like that, I'm afraid. So they weren't sort of trying, I mean, they were also trying to sound like Dickens and Collins, but they turn out to be clues, and in a way, I'm slightly worried by this, but I think language works like that, and enough people have enjoyed solving the clues that I feel that I'm more or less okay.
Was the novel always called Possession, and can you tell us why? And is it a nod to Persuasion as well as all the other things in it?
It has that a bit, but it's called Possession because that was actually the very first thing I thought of. This is the only novel which started with the title. And I was watching Kathleen Coburn, the great Coleridge scholar, going round and round the catalogue in the British Museum. And I thought, my God, is she possessed by him? Or does she possess him? And then I got the idea of a novel called Possession. And then the language went on working. And I thought, there's also a sense of economic possession. Who possesses a poet's manuscripts? And I must have sat around for 4 or 5 years after that. And I suddenly thought that possession is also a sexual term. And so I thought, well, there have to be two pairs of lovers, a modern one and an old one. And that's where it came from. I think it's the only one of my novels that absolutely began with the title.
A fun question, like John Mullen, I looked up the blogs. And there was this amazing blog about your involvement with bathrooms, which I had not seen at all. I mean, you know,
what,
I was
bathrooms
sort of
in the book.
In the book,
yeah. Well, there is stuff about bathrooms.
Now,
in
there are bathrooms
the
in
thing
all
about
my books.
Bathrooms, yeah. Antonia.
My French translator Jean-Louis Chevalier, who went and died owing to smoking too much at Christmas, and whom I am mourning for, wrote a very complicated paper on bathrooms in the works of A.S. Byatt in French. In my first novel, there's a scene in a bathroom which is there because of my... I am obsessed by glass, and all my bathrooms have sort of A, reflections, and B, being able to see through. And George Herbert said, a man that looks on glass, on it may stay his eye, or if he pleaseth, through it pass, and then the heaven espy. And all my bathrooms have these possibilities of seeing through or looking at reflections. It's to do with the light in bathrooms. It's not actually to do with getting bathed, I don't think. But they tend to come back. Also, they're private, of course.
I thought it was a wonderful book on so many levels, but one of the things I loved about it was the sort of rising sense of excitement as you go through and you can't wait to find out what happens next. And I just wondered, when you were writing it, did you have that same excitement about you? You couldn't wait to get back to it? I'm just interested to know about that.
I did, in a sense, yes. I did, and it was the first of my books that had happened with, and that was because it began with the plot. And, you know, people talk to me about the characters, but actually this is a book that the plot matters. And I remember 2 black weeks sitting in the British Library not being able to think how to move the plot forward. And the important thing in the plot was actually the discovery of the manuscripts in Brittany, because until then the whole structure of it, the even pace of discovery.
Yeah.
I had to invent those manuscripts so as to keep moving forwards, and that was a calculated act, and it was actually quite difficult. I mean, really very difficult. And once I got it, then I could add everything else like muscles on a string. But the other thing was, I found I could use models from my non-academic reading. I was making a Marjorie Allingham novel. I was making a Georgette Heyer novel. I was working at the level of narratives that I'd read and read and read in bed when I didn't feel very well. And this was exciting because it brought out something in me as a primitive reader. I hope now that I have understood the importance of plot, which at that stage in the study of British literature was not a thing people thought was important, was
no,
it?
No.
Or in the study of any.
Or literature. Was a cheap trick, you know, that a few sort of people did, you know, as if Dickens would have been more interesting. They hadn't bothered so much about the plot.
Well, Dr. Leavis in my days at Cambridge said we shouldn't read Dickens, but for that reason, it was just plot.
Lots of plot, yeah.
And the Nouveau Roman in France, which was around at the time I was writing, deliberately got rid of plot.
Sort of return to bathrooms. What you didn't mention in terms of bathrooms was the mirror in bathrooms, and the quote that you mentioned from Herbert is about mirrors, and it just strikes me that mirrors are very important. The idea of the mirror that reflects back at you or you can look beyond is something that comes up again and again in your work. I wonder if you could talk a bit about that.
It's the mirror as opposed to the window, really. Because I think Herbert is thinking about a window.
Right.
And Iris Murdoch once quoted Sartre as saying that the novel was like being in a house where you just looked out of the window and one day you realised that you were seeing the window as well. It's a kind of image for sort of intellectual sophistication or whatever, whether you like it or not. I'm very, very afraid of mirrors. I am a child whose first cinema experience was Disney's Snow White. And that has scarred me and wildly excited me. Again, I say I was brought up by the Quakers. And what the Quakers say is you should never think of yourself. So really you shouldn't look in a mirror. And one of the things... I don't know if I've ever written this image, but the image of trying to dry your hair in a hotel bedroom in a mirror covered with steam from the shower, and a sort of, in fact, I will write this now. You point the hairdryer at the mirror and you get a face-shaped hole in which you can vaguely see yourself swimming to the surface. And the other thing, actually, at the time I was writing this, I think, was Sylvia Plath's poem about seeing your mother's face rising towards you in the mirror like a terrible fish. And so mirrors are terrifying. Windows are opening. Both consist of glass. Bathrooms, well, a lot of bathrooms don't have a window, but that's terrifying in itself. It's awful. We won't go there.
You referred to your Quaker upbringing, or at least education, and I wondered if you'd say anything about the significance of silence in the book. Roland wants silence, silence, and of course at the end the father of the girl keeps silent about being her father. And I wondered whether you were sort of offering silence as a counterbalance to all this mass of language that the characters are involved with.
I'm writing a short story about silence at the moment, only it's turning into a long story. And silence I need personally most desperately, and I believe often that you do best to keep silent morally rather than going and telling people things. And I think we live in a time when people communicate more and more and more and more about themselves and each other, and they don't sit by themselves in silence. My story is about a 12th century monk from a silent order of monks who finds himself in 2009 in Tooting Beck, in the very small flat of a young woman who is naked in a shower. And going along the road, there are a lot of motor cars going boom, 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 boom. And of course, he doesn't know what they are. And she's got two different kinds of music playing in this room. And he feels he's, well, I mean, he must feel he's going demented anyway. But I don't quite know how to end it. So I think he ought to teach her silence. She's rapidly losing her boyfriend because she can't stop talking and she can't stop ringing him up on the mobile phone. And the monk, of course, doesn't know what the mobile phone is, so he calls it the lozenge.
I've boasted to A.S. Byatt about how well spotted up on the novel you are. So is there anybody else who'd like to ask another of these, another question about how it works and what they thought about it?
Can we return to the nature of possession as you present it in the novel? I mean, you seem to be saying in the novel that ultimate possession will stifle intellectual curiosity, and that in some ways that Christabel has been irredeemably damaged by entering this relationship, and there was something quite marvellous about the two women on their own. Is that something that you feel yourself, that women somehow have to maintain their aloofness if they're to be intellectually creative?
That's a humdinger question, which is a word I think I've never before used. I feel very double about it. I feel people should talk to each other, men and women should talk to each other. I think I do have a kind of ideal D.H. Lawrence view of a human relationship in which people are evenly balanced. And I didn't understand at all when I first read Women in Love, when Birkin keeps shouting, "Don't use your word love at me, we don't want any of that." And then he starts talking about evenly balanced separate stars. And the next bit of your question is that I think throughout history, whether we like it or not, women have been possessions. They have been given away in marriage, and until very, very recently, they weren't allowed to have any private property or possessions. And all this is very much alive at the time of this story. It's, you know, if a woman does marry, she gives up what little independence she had. I think we now live in a time where it's much more possible for people to be balanced in relationships of whatever kind. But having said that, being a woman of my generation who has had four children, however much your husband helps you to balance the effect of childbearing on independence, biologically this can't quite happen. It just can't quite happen. A woman with small children becomes dependent. I mean, I may be just old. I know there's a lot of people around who are trying to disprove this observation. I've done a lot of dialogues recently with Semir Zeki, the neuroscientist, who has discovered the idea of medieval romantic love, in which the object is for two people to become one and then die. And I keep saying practical things about what about childbearing? And he just looks at me contemptuously. He says it's a brain concept that's fixed in the mind. And I mean, I do the dialogues because I think he's right, certainly, about large parts of history, that for some reason human beings have this idea that they should lose themselves and become one with the other. I've never had it. Don't like it. But I do love my husband, and we sit there perfectly equably discussing the grammatical mistakes in The Guardian every morning.
Within many of the letters, there are certain words which are crossed out, and I was wondering if these would have been legible to the characters themselves or not.
Yes, anything crossed out but present is legible to the characters. I mean, legible to the researchers who read the text. They read the text as we read it. And indeed, being good scholars, they will draw immensely complicated conclusions from the crossings out. But if it's there, they could read it.
Sous el azure, it's called, isn't it? Yes.
Is it?
Oh, yeah, by Mr. Derrida, yes, yes, yes. Very much more, something much more significant if somebody's tried to erase it and get rid of it than if it's just there. But you do that, don't you? I mean, can you... There's what in Christabel's letter that Ash never gets. She writes, "What have I done?" doesn't she? And crosses it out, I think. That's the only thing crossed out in it.
It's interesting because the age that we live in of word processes is going to obliterate all this fascinating area for scholarship of the crossings out.
Indeed it is. Yeah. I don't know, I mean, John may know how many writers religiously preserve early drafts. Even so, you can't preserve crossing out. I write with a pen. However, I've become more and more obsessive about my narrative proceeding on a piece of A4 narrow feint, uninterrupted by crossings out. So if I come to a point when I think all this phrase is wrong, I simply start a new page. However, I preserve the page with the crossing out and stick it in the archive. I don't think I've been doing that for all that long, comparatively. I went to a very interesting conference at the British Library, which is very exercised in its mind, you know, about how we now no longer have drafts and we can't see people's thought processes. When I was teaching, we used to teach two or three drafts of a poem by Tennyson, and it wasn't at all clear that his final version was the one we found most exciting, you know. On the other hand, sometimes I cross things out because they were very silly and I wished they weren't there. And I don't want a scholar in the future getting very excited by them.
Well, we've discovered, I mean, we probably knew this already, that whenever you ask Esparta a question of detail about her book, there's always a good answer. Just to say that it's been great to listen to the answers and to thank her so much for coming and talking to us.
Well, thank you.